Welcome to episode 131. Episode 131. Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
So, well, tonight we agreed to talk about the Sacklers, this family that owns or runs Purdue Pharmaceutical, and the opioid crisis or addiction crisis. And, well, the Sackler family, they are descendants of Isaac Sackler and his wife, Sophie Greenberg, Jewish immigrants to the United States from Galicia in Poland, who established a grocery business in Brooklyn, New York. The couple had three sons, Arthur Mortimer Raymond Sackler. So he has three sons, Arthur Mortimer and Raymond. They all went to medical school and became psychiatrists. Oh, they were often cited as early pioneers in medication techniques, which ended the common practice of lobotomies, and were also regarded as the first to fight for racial integration of blood banks. Interesting. In 1952, the brothers bought a smaller pharmaceutical company, Purdue Frederick. Raymond and Mortimer ran Purdue, while Arthur, the oldest brother, became a pioneer in medical advertising and one of the foremost art collectors of his generation. After his death in 1987, his option on one-third of the company was sold by his estate to his two brothers, who turned it into Purdue Pharma. In 1996, Purdue Pharma introduced OxyContin, a version of oxycodone reformulated in a slow-release form. Heavily promoted, oxycodone is seen as a key drug in the emergence of the opioid epidemic. Incidentally, Elizabeth Sackler, daughter of Arthur Sackler, claimed that her branch of the family did not participate in or benefit from the sales of narcotics. Historically, the drugs have been used for palliative care for terminally ill patients in a few acute settings, such as after surgery. Purdue wanted doctors to prescribe opioid painkillers more commonly for all kinds of acute and chronic pain. Purdue's core message was that OxyContin was both safer and more effective than other painkillers on the market, so it could be safely used to treat more kinds of pain than past opioids. A group of experts explained Purdue's role in a 2015 annual review of public health article. Between 1996 and 2002, Purdue Pharma funded more than 20,000 pain-related educational programs through direct sponsorship or financial grants and launched a multifaceted campaign to encourage long-term use of opioid painkillers for chronic non-cancer pain. As part of this campaign, Purdue provided financial support to the American Pain Society, the American Academy of Pain Medicine, the Federation of State Medical Boards, the Joint Commission, pain and patient groups, and other organizations. In turn, these groups all advocated a more aggressive identification and treatment of pain, especially the use of opioid painkillers. As a part of this effort, opioid companies and other AstroTurf groups branded doctors who continued to prescribe opioids cautiously as inflicted with opiophobia. In the ensuing years, the number of the opioid prescriptions grew to the point that the U.S. now far outpaces any other country in the opioid prescribing. Addiction and overdose deaths followed. OxyContin is an extended-release opioid, meaning its active ingredient is supposed to disseminate into the body over a long period of time to spread out the effects and avoid causing a high or an overdose. Purdue claimed this made OxyContin safer than other opioids. But people learned OxyContin could be crushed and snorted or injected to get the full effect. This is actually more dangerous, delivering opioids meant to be disseminated over hours in one hit. Misuse and addiction proliferated among not just patients, but also friends and family of patients, teens who took the drugs from their parents' medicine cabinets, and people who bought excess pills from the black market. OxyContin also wasn't as effective as claimed. The drug was marketed for its supposed ability to provide 12 hours of pain relief, but that wasn't true, and there were warning signs during the drug trials even before OxyContin went to the market. Purdue, however, ignored concerns and encouraged doctors to prescribe high doses if patients didn't get the 12-hour relief they were promised, putting the patients at a higher risk of overdose and addiction. More than half of the long-term Oxycontin users are on doses that the public health officials consider dangerously high, according to an analysis of nationwide prescription data conducted for the Los Angeles Times. In 2018, multiple members of the Raymond and Mortimer and Sackler families, Richard Sackler, Teresa Sackler, Kathy Sackler, Jonathan Sackler, Mortimer Sackler, Beverly Sackler, David Sackler, and Eileen Sackler, were all named as defendants in suits filed by numerous states over their involvement in the opioid crisis. Just recently, Purdue Pharma has secured support from 23 states and thousands of local governments for a multi-billion dollar settlement that could enable the drug maker to resolve much of the opioid litigation it faces through a planned bankruptcy restructuring, according to people familiar with the case. The OxyContin maker and its owners, the Sackler family, have been fighting 2,500 lawsuits brought by virtually every state, as well as cities, counties, Native American tribes, and others accusing the company of helping fuel widespread opioid addiction. Resolving the entirety of the litigation at once has proved challenging, and the company still faces strong opposition to its current attempts to a settlement. The deal on the table would see the Sacklers exit the company, which would emerge from bankruptcy run by trustees tasked with paying out claims. The Sacklers would contribute $3 billion over several years, and potentially another $1.5 billion or more, contingent on how much is raised from the sale of another company the family owns, Mundi Pharma, which sells pharmaceuticals outside the United States. Purdue has tentative agreements with 23 states and three U.S. territories, as well as attorneys representing thousands of cities and counties in lawsuits in federal court. The company is trying to persuade the remaining states to join the deal as it prepares to file for bankruptcy. Since 1996, more than 200,000 people have died of painkiller overdose deaths. With another roughly 200,000 dying from other opioids, in many cases after using the painkillers first. Purdue is one of the companies at the forefront of the marketing of opioid painkillers, pushing doctors to prescribe more and more of the drugs and claiming that OxyContin was safe and effective even after reports of addiction and overdoses surfaced, according to lawsuits filed against the company and reporting on its marketing. These same lawsuits and reporting shed some light on the role of several members of the Sacklers, many of whom have been named in the lawsuit, most notably Richard Sackler, who was president of Purdue after OxyContin was launched, and was closely involved in messaging and marketing of the drug. The lawsuits are, according to plaintiffs, meant in part to stop future companies like Purdue from misleading and aggressive marketing of these dangerous projects. Other companies sued are Johnson & Johnson, Endo, and Teva Pharmaceutical. Federal state officials could investigate it as a criminal matter. They could target the Sackler family and members themselves, particularly those that were close to Purdue. Feds, of course, have taken similar action against other smaller companies in the opioid crisis, like Insys Therapeutics, but have yet to take a criminal case against the Sacklers and Purdue Pharmaceutical. Of course, it's not illegal for a pharmaceutical company to sell its products, even potentially risky ones, as long as it has approval of the Food and Drug Administration. The thinking is where Purdue and Sackler's went wrong is misleading marketing. They misrepresented their product, claiming they were safer and more effective than they really were for years. University of Iowa law professor Mihalis Diamantis said the misleading marketing opens Purdue and potentially the Sacklers, depending on how involved they were, to charges of misbranding, illegal drug distribution, and conspiracy or racketeering. One possibility is charging the Sacklers under the Responsible Corporate Officer Doctrine, which attempts to hold company leadership accountable for wrongdoing by people under them. What's legally tricky, experts say, is the leap from Purdue's wrongdoing to the Sacklers' personal liability. Based on the lawsuits, it might be relatively straightforward to make a case against Purdue as a whole and executives who were directly involved in misbranding and misleading marketing opioids. But the Sacklers, especially in more recent years, have played a less direct, high-level role in the board of directors. The question becomes just how involved the Sacklers were in day-to-day dealings of the company, how much of a role they had in any misleading marketing efforts. There is some evidence that the Sacklers were pretty much involved, according to Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey's lawsuit against Purdue and the Sacklers. Members of the Sackler family regularly got reports on the opioid marketing efforts. As part of this, they were once given a list dubbed Region Zero, which tracked doctors who were suspected of diversion and abuse. In the same meeting, the lawsuit said the Sacklers voted to expand the sales force by 125 more reps. The Sacklers would continue pushing the company to aggressively market opioids. Based on the Massachusetts lawsuit, Richard Sackler in particular demanded regular updates on what was becoming what was being done to boost the sales numbers. He was especially interested in pushing the marketing and sales of stronger doses because those brought in bigger profits. Purdue and three executives pleaded guilty in 2007 to charges related to misbranding. Three executives, including then-president Michael Friedman, who were each sentenced to 3 years of probation and 400 hours of community service, and they had to pay tens of million dollars in fines, but they served no prison time. You can go to prison for accidentally killing one person with your car. That's the minimum standard, Rick Claypool, a research director at Public Citizen, said. The idea that you can run a company and cause societal-level devastation and walk away from that relatively unscathed is mind-boggling. U.S. yearly overdose deaths and drugs involved among 70,200 deaths in 2017, the sharpest increase occurred among those deaths related to fentanyl and synthetic opioids. The opioid epidemic, also known as the opioid crisis, refers to the extensive overuse of opioid drugs, both from medical prescriptions and from illegal sources. The epidemic began slowly in the United States beginning in the late 1990s and led to an enormous increase in the opioid use in recent years, contributing to over 70,000 drug overdose deaths in the U.S. in 2018. Per day, there are about 130 people that die from the opioid-related drug overdose. Opioids are a diverse class of moderately strong, addictive, inexpensive painkillers prescribed by doctors. These, along with a much stronger synthetic opioid, fentanyl, have made them popular as medical treatments after surgery. With heroin and illegal street opioid, they have become recreational drugs despite the high risk of addiction and overdose. The opioid epidemic has been described as a uniquely American problem, with prescription rates alone are 40% higher than in other developed countries such as Canada and Germany. This has made it one of the worst drug crises in American history, causing more deaths annually than car crashes or guns, and leaving many children orphaned. As a result, the government began cracking down on pharmacists and doctors who were overprescribing opioid painkillers. Those addicted to opioids, both illegal and illegal, are increasingly young, white, and female, with 1.2 million women addicted compared to 0.9 million men in 2015. The population of rural areas of the country have been the hardest hit. Teen abuse of opioids has been noticeably increasing since 2006, using prescription drugs more than illicit drugs except marijuana, more than cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine combined. The crisis has changed the moral, social, and cultural resistance to street drug alternatives such as heroin. In 2011, the Obama administration began to deal with the crisis, and in 2016, President Barack Obama authorized millions of dollars in funding for opioid research and treatment, followed by the Centers for Disease Control director, Thomas Friedman, stating that America is awash in opioids. Urgent action is needed. Soon after, many state governors declared a state of emergency to combat the opioid epidemic in their own states and undertook major efforts to stop it. In July 2017, opioid addiction was cited as the Food and Drug Administration's biggest crisis, followed by President Donald Trump declaring the opioid crisis a national emergency. In September 2019, he ordered U.S. mail carriers to block shipments of the most powerful and dangerous opioid, fentanyl, coming from other countries. What the U.S. Surgeon General dubbed the opioid crisis likely began with the overprescription of opioids in the 1990s, which led to them becoming the most prescribed class of medication in the United States. Opioids initiated for post-surgery or pain management are one of the leading causes of opioid misuse, where approximately 6% of people continue opioid use after trauma or surgery. Let's see here. In U.S., addictions overdose effectively mostly non-Hispanic whites from working class, Native Americans, and Alaskan Natives experienced a fivefold increase in opioid overdose deaths from 1999 to 2015. This is a rundown of the Sackler family and the opioid crisis. Joe, what's your take on it?
Oh, well, first I would point out that the Sacklers claim that, they're surprised by what has happened is demonstrably disprovable, because this is not their first go-round at narcissizing America. You have to remember that these guys are the same group that back in the 60s created Librium and Valium. And that was really the very first drugs that ever actually generated over $100 million in sales. And they were completely, basically, they are, even though they're not actually synthetic opiums, they have very much the same idea behind them. They just put the person into a trance, basically. I don't know if you've ever seen anyone on a Valium or a Librium high, but they're just, it's very akin to someone who is stoned on heroin.
Is this what that song, the Mother's Little Helper by the Rolling Stones, was about?
Yes, that's right. And so the idea that, you know, this is some kind of a shock. I mean, they've been working at this thing for over 60 years, for heaven's sakes, you know, and they've, the amount of money that they've made is just beyond belief. And beyond this, you know, you talked about the government's response. I mean, this is all absurd. The government has always permitted them just to sell as much of this stuff as they possibly can. In fact, I think this year will be the first year, Tim, a breakthrough where we've been able to, in America, to have over 300 million prescriptions for painkillers written by our healthcare providers. 300 million prescriptions for painkillers in 2019 by healthcare providers. I mean, the Hippocratic Oath is so completely breached at this point. It's like a dam that's like been, you know, blown up and is no longer even has any sort of banks to it. The river of evil is just flowing over the thing. So, okay, so the Sacklers, have created this way of taking us into a drug trance. And if you don't mind, I'll just, give my idea of the context of all of this. It takes just a few minutes, but, you know, kind of disjointed, but I hope people can follow to get a sense of it. You want to understand what's going on. I would suggest read the analysis I did of The Tempest, which is available online. It's free. It's basically Shakespeare's apocalyptic Brave New World. Or you can just Google it, Atwell and The Tempest, and you can come up with the analysis. And, you know, I show that The Tempest was a play by this, whoever Shakespeare was, which is basically a fantasy fulfillment, the play The Tempest, of Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, which has, the character Ariel and then a tempest, and then the Gentiles have all of these strange things happen to them, and eventually you have this apocalyptic world where the Gentiles are gone. There's an owl, like the Bohemian Grove symbol of the owl, or the owl and the dollar bill. And then the next thing you know, you've got basically a planet where you just have the chosen people and everything is terrific. It's a little, Isaiah's a little cryptic, but that's, I think, actually what is inside this. And in the play, The Tempest, you have this idea that the Gentiles are basically put into a dream state. And so you actually have the fulfillment of Isaiah 29. Isaiah 29, it says that it shall be even as when hungry man dreameth, and behold, he eateth, but he awaketh, and his soul is empty, or as a thirsty man dreameth, and behold, he drinketh, but he awaketh, and behold, he is faint, and his soul has appetite. So shall the multitude of the nations be that fight against Zion. Okay, so basically, you have this idea of the dream, that they're put into a dream and they think things are going well, but this doesn't work out. Now, this is, it's not just some cryptic thing, Tim, because this is the play where the expression Brave New World comes from, right? And this is what the author is actually referring to by this Brave New World. I mean, brave is being used as a a synonym for, you know, distraction. For in this era in Shakespeare's time, that's what kind of the word meant. So you've got this drug-like distraction going on, and then Huxley reuses the phrase, but he reuses it when he titles his book Brave New World, exactly in the same context that Shakespeare does. This is what Brave New World is about. It's about this world which has now been achieved, actually. And if you notice, what has happened is you have drugs. Soma now is just basically ubiquitous, and this is how all tension, all resistance to the authority is dealt with. They just give them soma. So when you come to the Sacklers, this is basically what is going on. I mean, this is not being done for money. It's not being, the Sackler family, they're part of the Federal Reserve System. They don't need a dime. They have access to whatever dollar number they need. This is done, their program is being done to basically create a drug state while, the technologic slave state is implemented. And I would say that hand in hand with the 300 million pain pills, is the autism crisis. You've got this other aspect of the Brave New World that Huxley predicted, where you need the deltas and the epsilons. So in the drug state, people are less likely to see what's going on, and so when the Sacklers are able to, get this very powerful derivative of heroin into mainstream America, it just ratcheted down the capacity of the Gentiles to know what in hell's going on. So that's basically what has what has happened to us. And when you look at the fatalities of how many people are dying in this crisis. I read in one statistic that it was over 70,000 Americans were dying, and this is actually impacting the longevity statistics for European Americans now, where we're actually losing our, the lifespan is decreasing because the opioids and all of the misery are basically having people end life faster. I was happy to see, for a point of clarification, that the Sacklers brought in the temple to ISIS. I don't know if you followed that, but they paid to have an 800-ton actual temple from ancient Egypt, which has the god Horus, the foundation god of Freemasonry. The wing sun disc is right actually above the entrance. So they brought that in and set it up in New York. It's just a hideous stone weird thing, but it's important because it shows how, the context that I'm trying to, show, that this is a long-standing program, is understood by these guys for sure, and then I just wanted to wrap my little piece up here by pointing out that the Sacklers are not, this isn't like the first go-round for this kind of Masonic basically destruction of a country through opioids, because the group that brought the opium into China were the Masons. And so when you see the Sacklers, setting up their temple with Horus, you've got, you have a really clear connection back to the lodge system that was set up in India to develop the opium growing, and then the military side of Freemasonry, which implemented it. And Tim, it is even the Masonic basically control over the opium into China, even went into the triad system, because you can see this because the triads, you know, once the Masons gained control over these regions in China, the triads developed or actually adopted the Masonic grip system. I mean, it wasn't a mimic. I mean, it wasn't a, you know, similar. They actually adopted the grip system. So they became part of the Masonic, you know, sort of levels and control and probably oath swearing and things. And so when we look at the, you know, 300 million prescription for pain pills, supposedly, and we look at the 80,000 people a year dying, this is, and then of course you look at the absurd, supposedly, you know, government reaction and resistance, which is basically zero, right? The Oxycontins are still being sold. I mean, there's nothing is really being done to stop them. So, you know, people have to understand that, that we are under attack, and that this is a, you know, one of the key aspects of the attack is to keep us drugged up. So I wouldn't under any circumstances take Oxycontin. Any physician that prescribes it at this point is, you know, is basically dangerous to you. I mean, I know there's, you know, extraordinary kinds of pain, but this particular version of synthetic opium is just so dangerous that the addiction to it is so easy to fall into that you just have to avoid it. And, you know, people should understand that, you know, when they have a family member who's using it or they know someone, for heaven's sakes, who are strung out on it, they just have to try to intercede here and just cut it off. And then, I mean, this is, it is a catastrophe, and it is an aggressive part of genocide. And I, I just hope that our show helps make people aware of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history to this. I mean, you mentioned the Opium Wars, and of course, there was a British Freemasonry, and also the Sassoon family. Who would eventually marry into the Rothschild family, and also which would then buy, you know, peerages within the British establishment in the 19th century.
Yep.
And of course, that was, you know, the purposeful and intentional takedown of society by opiating the masses, the people there, because they found they had a demand for opium, and And of course, America today, the opioid crisis, the reasons, you know, what's causing it, you know, you have America's cultural, economic, and spiritual decay. And this creates a lot of depression and malaise in certain areas of the country, which then makes some people more susceptible to drug use. And then you bring in, this brings up questions of other policies, like economic policies or geopolitical policies that have contributed to this situation. You've had a long standing within the medical community, as doctors have been turned into pain or pill pushers. The aggressive marketing by pharmaceutical companies, and this happened in the 1970s when the pharmaceutical companies started paying for ads in medical journals. And a deal was struck, I think, in the 1970s with psychiatrists who were considered the lower rung of the medical establishment, that they would fund psychiatry's research and buildings, and they would raise the prestige of psychiatrists if psychiatrists pushed drugs. And that's when psychiatry de-emphasizing couch time and started emphasizing just, prescribing various types of drugs to deal with mental issues or problems or illnesses, as they say. And of course, one of the reasons why the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, keeps expanding is if you can identify a mental illness, give it a classification or a name, then you can usually find an excuse to apply a drug to it, and drugs will become marketable and sales will go up. But the opioid crisis itself, some people have referred to it as white death, because it seems to be affecting middle America, white Americans, the most. And so what's causing this? Look at what's happening to American culture and American society. And since the 1960s, you've had, since the rise of the counterculture, you've had this cultural revolution, the sexual revolution, the breakup of families, the confusion that comes from that, the distress that comes from that. Also, the economic policies of the 1970s, the deindustrialization of the United States, the explosion of debt, and even the trade imbalances, which is funny, because that always seems to factor into the drug trade, is manipulating trade balances. So it's left large swaths of the countries without industry, without employment, and this leads to, again, malaise and depression, which again often people seek drugs to ease their pain, if not physical pain, their mental pain, their anxiety, their concerns. And so we have to ask that question: is why is this being done? Why the cultural changes, or and who's behind that? This is an article that Kevin McDonald wrote a couple of years ago, talking about the marketing strategies and same of the use of science, these things, the misuse of science to go after the. But he describes as, the European population of the United States. First you had Franz Boas using sociology to create the justification for forced integration and the breakup of white communities or cohesive ethnic communities. And the same way that they've done now with, they've applied the same techniques to marketing, with these drugs and painkillers, is it's all science. But it's really, it's an abuse of science or a malpractice of it. So I think you have to also have to look at the general culture decline of the United States. If you want to look at what's causing the drug addiction explosion, it isn't just the overprescription, overuse. It's also the cultural decline of the United States since the 1960s. And you have to ask yourself, who is primarily responsible for that? Is there a group that's primarily responsible for that?
Yeah, there is. You talk about the marketing techniques. I mean, remember that when they brought out Valium, I mean, it's a completely destructive drug. It just basically disorients people and gives them a buzz. It was given for anxiety, but then became prescribed for almost everything. I mean, just any pain, having a bad day at work. Valium was just being used everywhere. And what the Sacklers did was they created a medical newspaper called the Medical Tribune. Ever heard of that? Mm-hmm. It was like the first kind of pseudoscience, basically attempt to really shatter, the Hippocratic Oath. They got this thing out, this Medical Tribune, to 1 million physicians in 20 countries. On a monthly basis. So this was enormous. And what this did was, what the Medical Tribune did was basically just give all kinds of pseudo, kind of scientific ideas why it was a good idea not to let this unbridled anxiety, penetrate society. And we really needed to, you could address it with Librium and Valium. So this, what, when you get to, what happened with OxyContin, it wasn't the government, which it just shows you. I mean, that just couldn't be clearer that the government is in on the deal. That the first resistance against OxyContin came from a pharmacy benefit manager, right? Like an insurance company. It's called Merck Medco. With 1997, I think. And so they were a pharmacy benefit manager. Okay. And they could see that, you know, there was just all kinds of problems with people becoming addicted, chronic pain patients, so-called, ending up addicts. And these guys, Merck Medico, they were concerned that they were going to be on the hook in case there was like physical collapse of these guys. So they went after the science of Purdue, you know, saying, look, this is just ludicrous. And, you know, the doctor should stop, you know, prescribing it. So then Sackler, he did the same thing here that he did with Valium. And so he then sent out this idea that they would go around and make presentations to physician groups to specifically rebut Merck Medico's guidance, specifically, you know, to rebut that. And so in the presentations, they claim that OxyContin, and this is just, I mean, it's almost in hindsight, just you just want to laugh, but tears are also appropriate. Their claim is that the controlled release aspects of OxyContin made it less likely that people would become addicted or would use the drug for like a diversion, you know, for pleasure. I mean, it's just, of course, at this point, it's just insane. I mean, right, the addiction is through the roof. You couldn't have it, you know. So, but in any case, that was actually how they went after the Merck Medico's, attempt to like stop doctors from using it. So in this, incidentally, that will be like, and when you talk about these lawsuits, that will probably become quite, focus if the lawsuits ever do get the high profile, because it does show basically, you know, kind of an awareness and a plan to basically use the drug for a malevolent purpose. They, of course, the Sacklers can always fall back on, well, we're just evil, greedy people, right? They have that as the fallback. But I would think anyone who knows anything about the family and its wealth would realize that's ludicrous. I mean, what is really in back of it is the fact that they did want to addict America to mind-altering drugs. I forget what aspect we were talking about, but I said the principle that people, I think, can well apply is that of what has happened was the plan. So when you come to 300 million, you know, pain medication prescriptions in a year, which is basically, you know, 100% of the population, how you get there? Well, it wasn't through accident. It wasn't through greed. It wasn't through, you know, bad medicine. That was the plan. And the government was always involved with it because the government, of course, is corrupt and is run by the same secret society. And I'll just throw in one little, you know, bonbon because it's topical. It's happening this week. You know, you have this vaccine problem, measles outbreak in Samoa, which is being used as a way to bludgeon, what they call the anti-vaxxers. And, you know, once again, our government is there supposedly trying to help us. Now, in that situation, they're having a fatality rate of between 1 in 50 and 1 in 60, which is just, I mean, basically one of the most lethal kinds of illnesses you could ever have. Now, this is completely impossible, just given many things, but the Samoans are very international people. They travel all the time, they have airports, and they're all over the place. So the idea that this is somehow the island was cut off and this is the onset of the first measles things, you know, and that's why these things are, the fatality rate so high, is not correct. They had an epidemic in 1911, which was the first measles outbreak in Samoa. That was very, very high fatality rate. But since then, the people have adjusted to the disease, and now they have the baseline, which is very similar to the United States, which is 1 in 10,000. 1 in 10,000. That would be the fatality rate. But no, here you've got 1 in 50, 1 in 60. Between, you know, the stats are kind of unclear, but very, very high rate of lethality. So the government should be focused on that as to, well, what is changing, you know, the measles, you know, what is making it into this virulent killer of human beings, you know, when it's been, you know, not really having that effect for so long. But no, the government and the media are having a riot. It's a complete riot. And the whole purpose of the Samoan, you know, event is that they're going after the anti-vaxxers. So I would say that this is basically the same situation that occurred with OxyContin. OxyContin, you know, it didn't have the kind of, it just occurred over such a long period of time and was in kind of a slow motion process that it didn't ever get the high level of, you know, publicity that, you know, the Samoan measles epidemic did. But it's the exact same thing. The government is not our friend. You know, anyone who's ever watched the events of 9/11, clearly you can see that the government is malevolent. It wants to destroy you. It is in the process of destroying you. And so when you see the government response to this absolute crisis in OxyContin is literally zero, that they did nothing, that then what the correct response is that was the plan. And so now Trump is, you know, he's, you know, it's there'll be a hue and cry that will accomplish nothing. And if we are going to head this thing off, we have to look to one another. We've got to, you know, forget the government. It isn't going to help. We need to basically organize ourselves into an information chain, try to get people aware of the fact that the OxyContin is an attack. And, you know, and just, you know, if you have a family member that's going to be experiencing pain after an operation, you know, there's plenty of services online where you can get ideas about other ways of dealing with it than with synthetic heroin.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same way you should ask yourselves why I think as many as 1/4 of college students are on mind-altering drugs prescribed to them.
Yeah.
That's the same, I guess, culture or attitude which is leading to these addictions overuses or uses of these drugs. It's to, again, to opiate the masses, which is, you know, one of the objectives laid out in Brave New World with Soma.
And see, that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with Soma, and the government basically is not there to be our friend. It's there to be our slave master.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in this article by Kevin McDonald, he writes, "A theme of culture critique is that Jews are fundamental to the success of the counterculture revolution in the 1960s, whether it was the leaders of the campus radicals promoting the sexual revolution. Chapter 4 is dedicated to the assault on traditional Western sexual culture by psychoanalysis and related movements." As Norman Potter notes, it is in fact the case that Jewish intellectuals, Jewish organizations like the American Jewish Congress, and Jewish-dominated organizations such as the ACLU have ridiculed Christian religious beliefs, attempted to undermine the public strength of Christianity, and have led the fight for unrestricted pornography. He continues, "We should never forget that this war was inaugurated by Sigmund Freud, a fake scientist who hated the people and the culture of the West and imagined himself as Hannibal conquering Rome. And of course, people like Freud have come a long way in accomplishing just that. This was not a revolution motivated by love of humanity, but by hatred toward the people and the culture of the West." He continues further down, "But here we are going to concentrate on whites." In his book, Coming Apart, Charles Murray notes that for whites, beginning in the 1960s, there has been an increase in crime, lower levels of religiosity, work ethic, and marriage. For the upper middle class, marriage went from 94% to 84% between 1960 and 2010. But for the white working class, it went from 82% to 48%. For the white working class, never married went from 10% to 25%, and there's been a dramatically lower workforce participation. Murray attributes this loss of virtue, but he doesn't seem to discuss the forces and motivations behind the massive cultural shift. It is common among critics of Murray to claim that these shifts are all about economics rather than the broader culture. From the perspective in the America 1963, a high school graduate might expect to find a job which would allow him to marry and permit his wife to the leisure to stay at home and raise children. He could buy a freestanding house and a car and still afford it to take the family on a two-week vacation every summer. The wife would have been reared with a view to preparing her for the duties of marriage and motherhood. She may even have taken home ec in high school. The problem with this is that all the trends affecting marriage and the family started in the 1960s when the white working class was doing well, reaching its heyday in the early 1970s and stagnating thereafter. The steep upward trend in social family dysfunction begins in the 1960s and continues to climb up until around 1990 when it temporarily falls back before reaching new highs. By 1970, the white working class was at its peak. Out-of-wedlock births had already increased threefold from the 1960 level. So you have, again, the cultural war. You have, again, you have the introduction of drugs. Of course, the cultural war facilitates that. You also have, a weaponized medical community, which is using the, I guess, science and their expertise, their status to promote this. So it's being done at multiple levels. It's hard to believe that you can look at this and say, oh, well, it's just happening. It's not organized in any fashion. You know?
It's very hard to believe. And also, it's very hard to believe that when you stand in front of someone who is a doctor, that you might be dealing with someone who is an agent of your destruction. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest shifts that people have to make, mm-hmm. is that the physician class, and you can see it when you look at Sackler's, 1 million people that he was sending this propaganda piece out to, and there was no resistance. I mean, it's not like there was a magazine that came forward to resist that. Right. Sackler got to get out there with his propaganda. No one fought him on it. The government doesn't fight him on it. They bring out OxyContin. The government does nothing about it. So you have to, when you go to your family physician, you're either dealing with a thought puppet, right, which is often the case. I mean, they're just mistrained in medical school and are passing out the drugs that they're told to. Or someone who's an actual agent against you, right? Mm-hmm. Plenty of them too, as McDonald points out that the malevolence is everywhere. And so, it's we need to have that kind of cunning and self-awareness of an animal that is a prey item, you see. My feral cat has lived for 9 years, and we've watched it be attacked by bobcats 3 or 4 times, which means it was attacked probably 10 times that over the 9 years. They never catch it because it has every angle worked out, and it's absolutely, the animal's always alert. Well, I know this sounds exhausting. It's not what you'd want, I guess, certainly isn't something that, you would take a drug like OxyContin to create. But that attitude of just absolute the alertness, awareness of an animal that's being attacked all the time is what we have to develop, because we're really at the point where you can see how there isn't much left of the plan they need to implement, because with vaccinations, with OxyContin, and with the pornographic media, I mean. They and of course with weaponized integration, they will just flatten us here very quickly. I sent some information to you this last week. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but it was just on the collapse of birth rates in Europeans over the last 20 years, and how it's so catastrophic that even the models, for Social Security and economic growth, all these things are going to mm-hmm. fail. Because the population is declining so quickly,
this requires a cultural economic warfare. I mean, you have to look at it as warfare because you want to create an economic environment where it's difficult to have a what we would consider traditional normal family structure, wage earner, father, and a mother at home. Also, the cultural, which is the women aren't even inclined to even think in these terms anymore. And that's the culture, that's feminism, that's Helen Gurley Brown, Cosmo, that type of thing. Promoting all these things, materialism, these things. Because but it's a short-term model because what it does is it produce, if you're not, you don't have children, you're a wage earner, you're a much bigger consumer. Whereas if you have children, your resources are devoted to the rearing and raising of children. And ironically is that, you know, that type of life may produce statistically a lower GDP, but society's wealth, the GDP isn't everything, because people aren't, there isn't the, you know, the same velocity of current of consumerism transactions going on. But the thing is that society, which is addicted to consumerism, is parasitical. It's not reproducing itself. It's not sustainable.
Yeah. So when, you know, you take a drive through the inner city and you see just an absolute, you know, post-World War III apocalypse, when you see zero families being produced, and then you realize that the social programs that created this or were instrumental are still in play, right? Mm-hmm. The same exact programs. They've never changed. They've been enhanced.
Yeah, and all these oligarchic families, many, most of them are Jewish, support, you know, gay rights, transgenderism, you know, drag queen story hour, all this, you know, confusion, yeah, nonsense, degeneracy, which is not procreative in any sense of, you know, in any way. So, you know, but they all seem to support these, and big capital supports this nonsense, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we talked, and like we were talking about the Club of Rome, and I was saying, yeah, hey, it's like this DNA, it just pops up over and over again. You know, where basically debased culture, population reduction, you know, and of course Zionism, these are like the pillars that always just pop up somehow, you know, no matter what kind of secret society, what kind of organization comes into existence. They always seem to have those components, or they at least they never contradict them, you know, if they don't actually address those issues. So, you know, we're under attack, and you know, what people have to do, of course, is to make themselves really familiar with the nature of the attack so they can basically try to live a life in resistance to it, which, of course, when you look at, you know, looking at the OxyContin thing, Tim, it's kind of like, you know, looking at feminism or pornography to me. I mean, I know it's a little different, but it's basically, in my mind, it's sort of the same thing, that the same reactions required. You just don't do it, right? You just become aware of, you know, how feminism was weaponized if you're a woman. You try to look into your heart and see, you know, how it has basically been used to keep you from your real self. If you're male and you're pornography is something that you become addicted to, you just have to try to find a way to understand that this was a weapon and it's taking you from your real self. And the same thing here with OxyContin. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else we can do, Tim, but just appeal to people's better self and their clear mind, you know, that if you're using this stuff, and I hate to think, but just given the stats, I can't believe that the people who will be listening to this show, we're not going to have thousands of people that will be, you know, we're using it. You just have to try to get off and never, ever use it. Once you become clean, just stay the hell away from it. And any doctor that prescribes it, you have to avoid, in my opinion. I just cannot believe that a really ethical, caring doctor would ever prescribe this rattlesnake. So that's my opinion, is that you just have to go someplace else. And so if you know a doctor that has, you know, a way of dealing with pain, for example, after, you know, like a knee replacement surgery or something like this, then try to promote that doctor among your friends, because obviously he or she will be swimming upstream, mm-hmm, at this point, because the mainstream will be promoting the OxyContin peddlers.
Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting that, you know, this now it's gotten the attention of all these lawsuits. It's interesting to see how it resolves itself in the courts. I know they've filing for bankruptcy will protect him from further lawsuits, but it'd be see if there's a criminal case being brought here, because it seems to be at least there's grounds for a criminal investigation at the very least.
What the, I mean, the whole thing is just preposterous. I mean, look, I mean, this is like freeway, you know, Ricky Brown times a million. I mean, this guy, these actors have got, I mean, they're killing 70,000 people a year with OxyContin. And they're talking about whether or not there's going to be criminal charges. Well, you know, it's ludicrous. Of course, I mean, this. Yeah.
Like you said, one you kill one person in a car accident, you know, reckless driving, you can go to jail, but you devastate an entire culture.
Yeah, and kill 70,000 people. I mean,
yeah.
So you're talking about a million people have been killed. They're definitely bringing the drug into for cultural destruction, and the fatalities are just fine with them, right? I mean, they're just fine with them. It's just actually. An acceleration of the effect that they're trying to achieve with the drug. So if some 25-year-old kid ODs, man, do you think the Sacklers are concerned about that?
Well, the ugly truth is, when you're talking about drugs, the drug problem, the drug war in the United States, is that really no one wants to stop, at least no one in power. It's a trillion-dollar business, both for prescription drugs and, you know, illegal drugs. And it's how, as you just talked about, it's the way the elite control the planet or control the masses. And everywhere you look, I mean, the 1970s, the U.S. military and CIA were involved in Southeast Asia in facilitating the shipment of heroin into the United States, which was, was refined there and shipped in, flown into military bases, for Pete's sake. 1980s, there was going the dirty wars in Latin America and cocaine being shipped in. In the 2000s, we have Afghanistan. We've been there for 20 years, and during that time, opium production has skyrocketed. The Taliban actually stopped it, and you can't stop it. Actually, that's another thing. And now it's at an all-time high. So it's again one of these amazing coincidences, right? Where everywhere you see an intelligence operation or a military operation going on, you have an explosion in the drug trade in that area, and it's the market is the West, particularly the United States.
Yeah. Well, the market is the Gentiles. I mean, and so, you know, they have like freeway Ricky Sackler. He's supported by the thing that would be useful is if we actually had real political representatives would be to go at the Sacklers and try to see who in government they were working with to get this epidemic going.
Yeah, where was the FDA?
Well, yeah, where was the FDA? Where was the FBI?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is an attack. This is like a deliberate attack to kill millions of people. And where was the government? So, look, like I'm saying, is that we are like feral cats. We can't trust anybody. The government is clearly involved in this thing. You couldn't have done something like this. You couldn't get to the point. I mean. Freeway Ricky Brown couldn't get to the point where he was selling $1 million worth of coke a day or whatever a week, you know, if he didn't have government sanction. It just isn't possible.
Well, the biggest thing is like with this drug originally was for palliative care, which is a different thing because you have someone who's dying, right? So you have to worry about addiction. And then they start using it. They started, in fact, there was an organization that was in New York, it was tied to the Sacklers. Started lobbying for the wider use of OxyContin or at least the drug for more routine pain management issues, you know. So, I mean, usually if something's used for palliative care, it's pretty extreme.
Yeah, I would say that
apply to someone who's not.
Good point. Let me just give you. I this is kind of grisly, but I actually know a little bit about this. A friend of mine had cancer. He lived with us, and then. In spite of our efforts, he wouldn't resist, you know, chemo and radiation. But anyway, so he passed away and he had hospice care. And I was able to talk to like the people involved with that. And so how it works, it was OxyContin, believe it or not. And they kill him. So the way it works is they give him OxyContin in increasing doses or morphine. But in this case, it was just OxyContin. And so what... and they would just give him more and more of the stuff. And every time it got to the point where his pain or his discomfort, because he can't breathe, right? You can't breathe. then the response is to give them more of the stuff to bring the pain down, which of course then continues the process of basically suffocating them. And so that's palliative care, is a kind of slow motion murder, you know, and in California, at least in this case, I really was amazed at it, because I thought there was a chance he could recover. But once he went in, he just went into this process whereby he was always going to get some kind of opiate for his discomfort, and his discomfort was guaranteed to go up. Palliative care. So the idea of taking that drug, which is, you know, was, like you say, was designed basically to assist with passing on to the next life, and then putting it into a pain management situation, at the same time making sure that the most addictive aspect of it, which is the fact that it's time released. You see, this is the thing, is that, okay, so you have this, it's a different kind of opioid. It's a time release formula. So you've got constant small amounts of it being given to you all the time.
Yeah, it's like an internal drip. Yeah.
Yeah. The body never cycles away from it. You just build it up. And that's why it's so addicting. And Tim, the idea that they wouldn't have known this, it's ridiculous. Of course they knew it. This is what it was for. So they had the most addicting kind of heroin basically put into culture. And then they did this promo and knocked down anybody who pointed out that this was a super addicting formula with propaganda and with, and no doubt, because they had full FDA, CDC, you know, whoever they needed in terms of a government agency to back them up was available. And of course, the drug companies run the medical schools and the hospitals. My mom was in the hospital like about 9 months ago for a month or something. And I visited her every day, basically. And I'm telling you, the people who are in control of the hospitals are the guys with the suitcases, mm-hmm. the drug reps. And I mean, it was just shocking. They are everywhere. The drug reps are in every, the doctors come out of the op of like dealing with patients and go right into meetings with these guys. They are literally part and parcel of hospital activity. And of course I can imagine in the private care situation, it's even worse, you know, where, and they're there with like vacations. It's just, you know, how the thing works. But in any case, so we have a situation where
they hire like former cheerleaders to sell drugs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. And it's Hawaiian vacations, and you know, it's all this stuff. And
so that, Joe, there's seminars, not vacations. Seminars in the Bahamas in the wintertime.
Yeah, I was invited to go on one. I won't give in too many details, but it was to Whistler. Through like a friend of, you know, that said, well, come and stay with us at this ski resort. And, you know, we go, well, that's kind of expensive. They go, no, don't worry, we've got a condo. And I go, well, how are you guys affording? He goes, well, my boyfriend's a doctor. It's a convention. there's a seminar. and it's like, I mean, you know how expensive that is?
You know, this all goes back to our talk about, the medical establishment and Rockefeller medicine, or, you know, how only one type of, you know, official medicine is considered medicine, where if you had a freer system where your alternative care is being considered, you'd have a lot more research and development into, treatments that are more consistent with human health, long-term human health, than you do, you know, with pharmaceuticals, which are all based on, you know, petroleum industry, petroleum-based drugs. And this model was created, you know, with Abraham Flexner and the Flexner Report and the, you know, the creation of allopathic medicine.
Yeah. And you see, this is why the whole vaccine thing is so dangerous and we need to resist it so vigorously, is because what they're trying to do is establish the principle where the government has a right to get under your skin with chemicals.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what this is all about.
It's a cult vaccine, because people believe it's progress.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, it's considered just one of the things of modern society, one of the benefits where vaccines are necessary for sound public health. And it simply isn't the case if you read the history. It's quite the opposite, actually.
It's just preposterous, yeah. But they are establishing this right. I mean, with all of these different mandatory vaccine laws.
For something as trivial as measles, and you say they might be creating something more virulent in the process.
The thing is that what's really scary to me, or, you know, I'm never scared, but I it's curious to me, is, you've got the rate, which is well established, of 1 in 10,000. Mm-hmm. Samoans are a fully mobile country at this point. I mean, they travel. There's just, if you've ever been there, the planes are going in and out. There's Samoans everywhere, but in Hawaii and California. So they are completely... basically homogenized people in terms of their exposure to viruses. Mm-hmm. So they should be at the same exact baseline as everybody else, and have been. I mean, if you look at I actually went and dug into some of the statistics, and, you know, the Polynesians have long ago got into, like, basically the U.S. normalized, kind of death rates for these things.
Yeah.
But where is our government, our media, with that aspect? Because this is what's really is the important thing, is that what, 1 in 60 are dying as opposed to 1 in 10,000? What kind of measles are we dealing with here? So, you know, I think, frankly, it just smells rotten to me, because of the timing of it, because the anti-vax thing is such a powerful force in America. And this is, I think, going to be used as propaganda against it.
It goes back to the bigger question. Why would you trust the opinion of these so-called experts in matters of vaccines, when it's the same profession that got the United States addicted to opioids?
I mean, that is such a great point. And when you think about that, 300 million pain prescriptions a year being written.
Well, the third leading cause of death officially is, iatrogenic, which is a doctor, really. Cause death.
Yeah, that's right. And so they are. That's how dangerous these people are. How murderous they are. And so when you look at those.
Well, you don't need the constant prodding and poking and probing for good health. I understand you suffer a trauma. You get shot. There's something dramatic. But what they've turned it into, where everyone needs to be constantly seeing a doctor and not asking any questions and getting injected with mercury,
who knows?
Whatever falls into the vial, I don't know.
DNA. I mean, they've got so many weird things in
dead
this.
Baby DNA. I mean, it's
just, it's just disgusting. And so the citizens, I mean, we're kind of a bad situation.
And you mentioned with some of the diseases, the best way to go about doing it, the way that it's always been done, is that once a community gets exposed to diseases, they establish an immunity. And if that community, if they're breastfeeding and they're eating well, they have good health, that immunity will be passed on to the breast milk to the child, and the child's immune system will develop, become educated. And this doesn't say there aren't risks. There's always going to be some people dying who are sick in these things. But if you're talking about risk management, it makes no sense to, risk autism and whatever adverse effects are created by these foreign matters being injected directly into your muscle tissue, which is completely unnatural. As opposed to the slight-off chance you might die from a disease naturally. That's just life.
Okay, so they're pushing this herd immunity or community immunity aspect, and this is just absolute sophistry. So how that works is some guy in the 30s noticed that if like 60% of a herd or of a population of a town had been infected in the last visit by the virus, say, for example, measles. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now 60% of naturally immunized humans, in other words, who have gone through and had a real and honest immune system response to a virus, they have immunity for life typically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For life. And it's 99.9%. It's really strong immunity. Okay. So 60% had that experience of the current size of the community that's exposed, you see, that is a number that makes the spread of the disease more difficult for the other 40%, because, you just see the chain of infection gets blocked. Someone gets infected, but then the next person has immunity, and so that's the end of the chain. It stops there, right? So this is where the guy noticed that if he got over 60%, that it you didn't have these epidemics because it was really hard to have for the virus to spread, you know, because these 60% people were like blockers to the disease spreading. But this has nothing to do with vaccination. It's completely, vaccination is way too weak of an immune, you know, controller to ever produce this. There's no evidence at all that 60%, 7%, what they're talking, and now they're talking about 95%. And this is because the vaccines don't last very long. They're not for lifetime cheap things. I mean, now they're talking about, you know, boosters every like 4 years for measles, things like
that. Yeah, complete management, micromanage your health with needles. And
exactly. Yeah. Just and this is something like with measles that you know, you used to see the Brady Bunch movies about measles parties for kids.
Yeah, it was trivial.
And then you have an absolutely perfect immune system response, like you say, which then gets passed along to protect the children when they're born.
Well, the worst thing is if you do take the vaccination, and you run the risk of developing measles later on in life, which is much more problematic.
Exactly. So anyway, this is not, you know, this is not being done to help the health of the community. It's being done to create powers of government. It's sort of like the vaccination thing is akin to basically security at airports.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't being done to, you know, find terrorists because
these are the experts that want to give hepatitis B shots to infants.
These are the experts, right? And so they're establishing the power of the state to, you know, radiate you at the airport, and it's the same power that they're trying to develop to basically inject you with vaccines, and it's the same power that also permits opioids on a scale never before seen in history to infect our population. I mean, there it's a power of omission.
It's the same system that's also the mass production of fast food and processed food that are void of any real nutrition. So you develop inflammatory disorders, all types of health problems later on, which cause pain, which then cause you to go out and seek out painkillers.
Tim, touche. I mean, there it is. So the whole system is a suicide machine. You know, it's there to like basically make you, you know, continue to increase your Oxycontin uptake to the point where you can't breathe anymore. You know, and your palate, the whole culture is basically palliative care, you know. So we just have to.
Well, I'm just glad I have health insurance so I can get all this grid stuff.
You know, I have Medicare. I've never used it. I think I have. I think I went in once for I think I used it one time. But then the doctor was so disgusting. I just said, that's it. I'm done with that. So, okay, so you know, we are as animals are on this planet, Tim. We are on our own, and we have to like look to ourselves, our own families, our own, you know, our ethnicity, our friends, to try to find the best way to deal with sickness. Because honestly, I mean, the CDC, you know, the federal drugs. I mean, we could never have got to the situation where we are now with the obesity level, with the shrinking of lifespan, with the opioid addiction, with the vaccine injuries. You know, we could never have got there if they weren't actually organized against us. And that's really the message of, in my mind, of the opioid thing, is that it's just another example of how it's an aspect of destruction that the government is in league with the secret society, in league with all these cultural elements they control, has designed against us. That's really what we have to, you know, get people to be aware of.
And they're using incompetence as an excuse again.
And greed.
Yeah, and greed. Yeah, greed. Yeah.
Agreed. But the thing is that the Sacklers, they'll be fine to give them a couple billion dollars. Fine. What do they care? They're killing people at 70,000 a year. That's the statistic I got.
Mm-hmm.
They're just perfectly happy. You know, they've got all the money and they've got their little Freemason temple in New York City so they can go and stare at that whenever they feel lonely. So it's just, you know, it's a sick world. It's an infuriating world, and it's a world for, you know, for parents to hopefully pay attention to both. Now, just one more thing we got to watch out for is opioid use. I had a friend of mine had a knee replacement, and he used opioids. He used Oxycontin. Mm-hmm. And he used it for 2 days and then threw it away. You know why? Because he had become frightened of it, even though the doctor was recommending him to take it for like 10 days or something. But he stopped after 2 days. And it wasn't, you know, he's like not a, you know, kind of a, you know, he would be a normie in my, you know, my opinion. He's not someone who is, you know, understands like, you know, 911 or anything like this. So he's a normie guy. And yet he was afraid of Oxycontin because there's been enough percolation of information. Yeah. It's sort of like vaccines. You know, you get to these thresholds where just everyone's kind of talking about it. And they're going, gee, there's so much autism, you know. And so then you get the draconian pushback.
We should expect like a mandatory oxycodone law.
Of course.
You have to take it. Shut up.
Yeah, and I think it should be like expect mandatory palliative care in hospice, you know, you know, that's what they do. This is like the country is a palliative care center. You know, they're just here to manage us into our graves. You know, so we fight back. We don't put up with this. We won't permit it. We love our children. We want to have normal lives. And we're just going to do everything we can to like spread information to get people to be more and more aware. And so that hopefully we can have, you know, real political change, which would, you know, God help us, you know, that would entail basically, a very extreme social activity, you know, in order to bring it about. But hey, what are the alternatives, man? I mean, we got to do something.
Yep. Okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
Yes, sir, buddy.
Okay, Joe. Well,
Stay sober. Yeah. I'll try too, okay?
Merry Christmas, then.
Merry Christmas to you, Tim, and your family.
Thank you. Good night.
Okay, bye-bye.